Jean to Felix. The medicines are still used. That Sapaticia has some explaining to do. Another week and Alice was on her feet again, cured. Laying there in bed, I decided to give up meetings of the Child Help Program. Just too tired at the end of the day, she said, and looked it, her round face mottled and puffy as a cheese souffle.
Hitchhike,
whispered Jean to Felix, who was struggling into his old torn jacket. You just won't give up, will you? And he was out into the early darkness. Alice found the way.
You can get a ride. It seems like, she said, Johnny Stick is going that way. He's pretty good company now. He started going to those truth and reconciliation meetings a few years ago. Helps to know you are not alone in the boat.
What was the matter with him? Asked Felix, who picked up on a tone in her voice.
Oh, that bad stuff from years ago when he was a kid. The resi school.
Mr. Stick is all right to take a ride with?
Yes, he's fine. He's got a carpenter job up there fixing the handrail in the old lighthouse. It hasn't blinked a blink for sailors for 80 years, but the tourists like it. In the summer, there's a chips truck in the parking lot. Does good business, so that shaky old handrail got chip grease and salt all over it. He said be ready tomorrow morning, early. Bring your blankets. You can rough it a few nights.
Mr. Stick was in his late middle years, his dark jowls clean-shaven. The back of his pickup held an enormous red cooler, and under a tarp, the handrail sections for the lighthouse. He said,
Nice maple rail. Same finish like one of them no-stick fry pans. So where do you want to go on the Cape?
We don't know. I mean, we're looking for a woman named Sapaticia Sell, but we don't know exactly where she lives.
Here's the deal. You help me put that rail in place, you'll get a round trip and a place to sleep, and your dinner.
Jean nodded. Mr. Stick gazed out at the horizon for a long minute before he snapped to and said gruffly,
Then let's get going. Hop in.
He talked as he drove.
I know who you mean. Egasel's daughter, Sapaticia. There's not too many live out on the Cape except motel and restaurant people in the tourist season. I guess she's got a place out there. Somewhere.
They all knew everything was for the tourists, the despised tourists who kept Nova Scotia alive.
She knows about the old Mi'kmaq medicines. That's why we want to talk to her, said Jean.
Seen a woman go along the cliffs with a basket. I thought she was a berry picker first time I see her, but it wasn't the season. I never seen her up close to talk to. I knew Egga pretty good, long ago. At least I think it was her. Not sure. Cliff path below the lighthouse. Seen her when I was measuring for the handrail. Stayed 3 nights, slept in the truck, and I seen this woman a couple times. Must be good stuff grows down there.
Mr. Stick said,
She's a cell. Try and find a Mi'kmaq ain't related to a cell. Get up pretty early in the morning for that. I got some Ganek with Dagudijik cousin cells.
Driving slowly in the thickening fog, he said that Felix and Jean, between times of helping him, could watch for the woman.
Sapaticia, she went to university, travel all over the world. But I don't know if you'll see her, way the fog's working up. Not much hope for today, he said, as he turned onto the gravel drive to the lighthouse.
Look,
said Jean, pointing at the storage building. They all saw a fading movement.
No, I see her yet. Alatet, way over there.
Mr. Stick pointed at a blob that was gone as soon as he spoke.
Wait for morning. I think she comes back.
He made a fire in the parking lot, cooked hot dogs in a dirty cast-iron frying pan. Then, yawning, he said good night and retired to his truck, where they could see the glint of a bottle as he tilted it up. The cousins went into the lighthouse, unrolled their sleeping bags. All the next day, the fog hung heavy and unmoving. Felix and Jean held the railing steady while Mr. Stick bolted the sections to the braces. He fussed with joins and angles, took the sections down again, and made minute adjustments. He worked without talking. The light was dimming when he was satisfied with the railing. The next morning sprang open brilliantly clear with a snapping wind shooting up their jacket sleeves. Mr. Stick ate dry bread for breakfast,
didn't offer any to them, but drank deeply from his thermos of stone-cold black tea, then smoked his pipe.
"Gotta clean her up a little," he said, meaning the railing.
Jean and Felix climbed to the top of the lighthouse.
"Some view. I see two tankers. No, one's the ferry."
"I see Sepetitia Cell," said Felix. "Down there on the rocks." The woman in canvas overalls and jacket was digging with a trowel. A notebook lay open on a boulder, and the wind riffled the pages.
"Hello," called Jean.
The woman looked up at them. She was short and sturdy, black long hair in a single braid. Her narrow eyes looked Asian. She said nothing.
"Are you Sepetitia Cell?"
The woman picked up the book and set off rapidly down the shore with a plant still in her grasp, fragments of soil falling from the roots.
"Please wait! We want to talk to you!"
In a few minutes, they heard a distant engine start up. By the time they reached the bottom of the lighthouse, the red pickup was roaring along the road. Gone.
"I'd say she don't feel like talking," said Mr. Stick. 10 more minutes, then I'm heading back to Dartmouth. You want a ride? Or stay?"
"Yes, to a ride," said Jean, not looking forward to the fumigation, hoping Mr. Stick would stop at a store along the way. But he did not, drove faster and faster through the fog that had erased Sepetitia Cell. Mr. Stick, feeling obscurely responsible for the cousin's thwarted search, had gone to Lobert's cell, whose mind was failing, yet he seemed to know where Sepetitia's little house stood. He put his trembling finger on an inlet he said was Pussle Cove.
"Couple kilometers east of the lighthouse. No road sign."
Mr. Stick gave the smirched paper to Alice, who put it beside Jean's plate that evening. So she had an address. And to get there, she took money from her savings account at the East Coast Credit Union and gave it to Felix, asked him to rent a car. She had no license. The rain didn't matter, and the cousins had a sense of holiday freedom. The rental car hummed along, the wet roadside unfurled, and the windshield wipers beat a slow march. They shared a bag of jelly donuts Felix bought at Tim Hortons. They passed the Wreck Point lighthouse, and he slowed.
"That's it. Has to be."
Jean pointed at a faint trackway that sidled shyly off the main road directly into a patch of wind-racked black spruce.
"I see car tracks."
Felix turned cautiously into the watery ruts, dimpled by raindrops, and inched slowly between clawing branches. They looked down at a small, unpainted house on the edge of the sea, smoke barely clearing the chimney. Nearby, a wind-twisted spruce and an outhouse leaned west, a northern harrier huddled in the tree. Before they could knock, the door opened, and Sepetitia Cell, wearing a heavy gray sweater that looked like it had been knitted from fog and briars, stood staring at them without expression. She was not old, but weathered, a plank washed up on shore.
"All right," she said in a low voice. "Here you are. Again. Why? Who are you and what do you want? Ever hear of privacy?"
"We come up from Dartmouth," said Jean, and waited as though she had explained everything.
"I guessed that. Why are you bothering me?"
"I am Jean Cell, and this is my cousin Felix, also Cell. We are students. I read this article," she held the limp cutting out, "about you, and I have a question."
"What question?"
She did not take the clip.
"Well, you say that Mi'kmaq medicine plants from long ago can't be used now. Why not? I mean, if we know that a certain plant cured aches or itches, why wouldn't it be good to use it now? Our Aunt Alice just had the flu, and everybody brought her Mi'kmaq medicine, and she got better."
Sepetitia Cell made a sound halfway between a moan and a sigh.
"Good God, you came all this way to ask that?"
Salt-dimmed windows faced the Atlantic, and the ocean itself seemed hung in space. The only table in the room looked like it had been stolen from a provincial park. Near the door stood an immense cupboard, painted red.
"Used to be a fisherman's house," said Sepetitia. "Fixed it up.
Suits me the few months I'm here. On the west wall, Jean saw a bench cluttered with botanical instruments, a large microscope, a battered and age-blackened plant press layered with drying papers, dark stem ends protruding.
Sit, said Sapaticia Cell, jerking her thumb at the table.
So, you want to know so badly why we can't use the old medicine plants that you drive 100 kilometers on a stormy day to ask me who you don't know. Maybe you think I have an answer. I don't.
Her unbraided hair straggled over her shoulders.
Since the conquest, the air has been filled with pesticides and chemical fertilizers, with exhaust particles and smoke. We have acid rain. The deep forests are gone, and now the climate shifts. Can you figure out for yourselves that the old medicine plants grew in a different world? Felix, who had had many schoolyard fights, liked her low voice, but not her combative posture.
Those plants were surrounded by strong, healthy trees, trees that no longer exist, trees replaced by weak and diseased specimens. We can only guess at the symbiotic relationships between those plants and the trees and shrubs of their time.
She looked out the window, tapped her foot. And I must say you are unusual young people to come here looking for answers. Are you botany students?
They began to explain their lives to her, Alice's house, and how they came to be there.
You deluded idiots, said Sapaticia Cell. And now you will go back and continue your studies?
We have to pass the exams, so we can get into university.
Why do you want to do that?
To have careers. To be somebody.
You are already somebody. Do you mean somebody more important than poor Mi'kmaq students?
Yes, I guess so, said Jean,
and Felix, who did not want to nod, nodded.
It's not just ourselves, said Jean. Felix cares about the forests, she said, and I care. We want to do something.
Felix saw the woman's rigid shoulders drop a little. He told her about hearing Dr. Onohube's lecture on the boreal forest.
Well, Alfred does get people going.
Do you know him?
We've worked together on projects.
She got up and walked around, went to the door, opened and closed it.
You two are beginning to interest me now that we're past the medicine plants. You are young and green. You do not know how the world works or that you will be punished for your temerity and wanting careers.
Outside the window in the gathering twilight, Felix saw the northern harrier fly to its tree, something limp in its talons. Felix thought of the long drive back.
You sound like a teacher. Are you a teacher?
I've done the university things, teaching and lecturing.
I, too, wanted a career. I had a career. I left the career. I've learned enough to know that today the world we have made is desperate for help. Help that isn't coming. I don't teach now. I have a project and I work at it, with others. My interests are overlapping ecosystems, the difficulties in understanding the fabric of the natural world. So, if you came here looking for a discussion of research on medicinal plant genomes, you're in the wrong place.
Felix did not like her, but there was something, and Jean sat with her mouth open, staring hungrily at Sapaticia Cell, waiting for the next sentence.
We look at models, examine causation and apparent effect. We struggle with the wild cards, worry about population growth. Humans now outnumber every mammalian form of life that has ever existed. Maybe unstoppable. We have nightmares about oceanic currents and sea star die-off, melting ice, more violent winter storms. And we think about forest degradation. Forest, the beginning and likely end.
As Onohube says.
And then, in that low voice that sounded as though she were talking to herself, she said,
But others now suggest more frightening problems and ends than Alfred Onohube ever dreamed.
She seemed done with talking, thrust a notebook at them, and said,
Write down your address. I'll be in touch.
Then she sent them on their way. Moonlight. Autumn lurched clumsily out of the equinox, black ice one day, sunlight polishing tree branches the next. A few straggler tourists were still underfoot, as irritating as gravel.
Jean, who worked weekends at an information kiosk, collected, as everyone did, their idiotic questions, especially those from the Americans, who thought it might be shorter to drive from Halifax to Antigonish, counting miles rather than kilometers.
I'm late,
muttered Felix, a white rabbit running through the kitchen, snatching a half-cooked pork chop from the pan and dashing up the stairs.
Don't eat that pork, it's still raw, shouted Alice. Use some sense. And you got some mail.
Felix, simultaneously changing clothes and chewing on the red pork, looked at the clock. On his way to the back door through the kitchen, he dropped the pork chop back in the pan and picked up the buff envelope, saw Breitsprecher Tree Project and a Chicago address in the upper left corner. He stopped, turned the envelope over.
Jean get one too, just like that, said Alice,
nodding at Jean's plate, the envelope standing against it.
Late again. Something she has to do at the school.
Felix tore the end off the envelope and pulled out a letter. Something fell out as he unfolded it and fluttered under the table. He read the letter, and read it again, not understanding. It informed him that he was the recipient of a $5,000 fellowship from the Breitsprecher Tree Project and was signed by someone named Jason Bloodroot. What did it mean? Once more, he read the letter, retrieved the check from the floor. It was made out to Felix Sell. It looked real. The letter said he was to contact Dr. Sapaticia Sell within 10 days for further information about the project.
I'll be double damn, he said. Dr. Sapaticia Sell.
There was her address and her cell phone number.
He whooped so loudly that Jean, outside in the street, heard.
She came in to find them dancing around the table, tore open her identical letter.
You call her, said Felix. It's you who connected us with her, so you phone.
The next day, over the supper plates, Felix studied the provincial highway map, looking for an alternate route.
The trip was too long last time. But how about this?
He jabbed his pencil into the map. A shortcut. Jean was old enough to know that no man on earth could be deterred from taking an unknown shortcut. And now the lime green rental car thumped into the darkening morning. The coast road would have been better. The shortcut was like driving up a dry riverbed. Despite the rental car's chopped off look, as though a log slasher had got it, Jean thought it a technological marvel. She began poking at the GPS touchscreen. The back road was a roller coaster of broken asphalt. The car could not catch the rhythm of the frost heaves. There were no towns, no houses, only third-growth spruce and brush representing the great forest of an earlier century. At the height of land, they could see the dulled ocean and its gray line of rain. Tiny drops speckled the windshield.
I don't think this is the tourist route, said Felix, steering around a dead branch. Not sure where we are, and the city car doesn't like it.
But we can see the water, so the highway has to be between us and the shore. When you see a right turn, take it.
What time is it?
Almost 11. We'll be late. The car scraped through a series of potholes. Something dark and thin ran across the road.
What was that?
Mink. One of those big escaped ones from the mink farms.
You remember what Dr. Onohube said about those farms? Pollute the rivers, and the minks get out and breed with wild minks and make bad genetic changes?
The road degenerated into a stew of stones and mud. Felix clenched the wheel, drove very slowly, and the car struggled forward.
You know, Felix said, I found out something interesting about Dr. Sapaticia Sell. Guess.
What? She was elected prom queen back in the day?
Not likely. She was married. Married to somebody we know.
Who? Jean did not believe it. How could her hero have married anyone?
Well, not somebody we actually know. Someone we heard talk.
No! You don't mean that Onohube?
Yes, she was his student. And they got married.
Jean shuddered. She preferred to think of Sapaticia as a lone heroine.
Anyway, what difference does it make? They were divorced.
Jean said nothing.
Onohube's okay.
He got us going.
Wonder why they split up.
They descended the hill, past assemblages of motley boards and corrugated roofing, one with a hopeless for sale sign. Abruptly, the clouds began to rip open like rotten cloth, showing bright blue underskirts. As a slice of sunlight painted the drenched countryside, touched the sea, a flight of migrating birds cut the sky like crazy little scissors.
We'll get there pretty soon, said Felix, but I don't know where we are.
Jean began tracing her finger over the GPS touchscreen. A tiny red dot on a crumpled string of a road appeared.
Look, Felix, it shows us on this road.
All right, said Felix. Jean promised herself she would buy this model of car if she ever had the money. Suddenly, a loud female voice said,
In a half kilometer, turn right.
Jean shrieked. You don't get out into the world enough, said Felix, swinging onto the wet highway. The sun changed the macadam surface to black lacquer, and in a few kilometers, they passed the lighthouse. There was Sapaticia Sell's red pickup. Beside it, a rust-blotched sedan and a jeep so muddy it had no other color. Felix parked next to the jeep. At the lee side of the house, they saw two large tents. A sign on one read men.
The other one must be for women, said Jean. Are they toilets?
Now you sound like a tourist. The outhouse is over there, he told her, and jerked his thumb toward the unmistakable small building on the cliff. The northern harrier sat on its branch, eyeing them. I say the tents are for sleeping.
Let's go in.
The harrier rattled a loud, tek, 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 tek. The room looked different, richer in a homely way. The stolen picnic table was cluttered with papers, two laptops, a carton of almond milk, and some plastic plates. Sapaticia, two young women, one with elaborately coiffed black hair, the other white blonde, and a sun-darkened man in a checked lumberjack shirt sat at the table drinking tea. Wintergreen, thought Jean, catching the sprightly aroma, and eating takeout fried chicken legs.
You made it, said Sapaticia.
She was still in dirty jeans and the heavy gray sweater.
Sit down and have something. The coleslaw, where is it?
She half rose.
I've got it, said the man.
His eyes looked bruised. He was older than the others, tall and thin, with a scar that torqued his mouth into a crooked slant. He stretched out a long arm and pushed the coleslaw bowl down the table. He looked at Jean and Felix.
That's Tom Paulin, said Sapaticia, and she made sketchy introductions. Jean Sell, Felix Sell, Tom Paulin, Hugdis Sigurdsson, and Charlene Lopez. Let's eat now, and then talk about the project.
Her knotty dark hair was held back in a ponytail that resembled a Percheron's fly whisk. Her eyes reflected the window light with a pale flash. Felix repeated, Tom Paulin, to himself. Tom Paulin, the coleslaw passer. There was something about the man's straight back and the way he moved that indicated tension. They tossed the gnawed chicken bones into the stove. Jean smelled them scorching. Sapaticia said,
So then, briefly, the Breitsprecher Tree Project does forest replanting. We have ties with as many as 30 conservation groups, and we often work within their programs. The six of us make a work group. We like to have 10, but this time we have 6. A few more might come later. We will be the only team working in Nova Scotia this season, and there is a lot to do. We'll plant trees and monitor several test plots outplanted 3 years ago. We keep detailed notes on how well they are doing for up to 10 years. One particular plot was showing a lot of chlorosis last year. Dozens of variables. I have a pet site where we're looking for the effects of mycorrhizal fungi on seedling growth. Burned soil is deficient in mycorrhizae, and seedlings do not do well without them. Their presence increases nutrient and mineral intake. Sapaticia looked down the table at Jean and Felix, scribbling notes, Charlene staring back at her, Tom Paulin in his private distance. She said, Come back to us, Tom. She spoke softly. She knew a little about him, that he had been through deadly experiences in Afghanistan years earlier, and that after he came home,
Somehow trees had saved him. He looked at her, cracked out a blink of a smile like someone working a mirror against the sun. She went on.
Whenever we can, we'll visit the province's ecoregions, starting tomorrow with the Highland Plateau. It's useful to have a grasp of small areas, to know what is special about each. Once you understand how to assess different geographies, soils, and hydrologies, sizing up new places will become second nature.
Felix said, "You mentioned different countries. Will we go to other places or just stay here?"
Tom Paulin nodded, poured more tea into his personal cup marked with Mu, the Chinese ideogram for tree.
"For this 3-month session, you stay here. Next year, you may work in a tropical rainforest."
Jean noticed that Sapaticia's hands were dark, the nails broken. She looked at her own white, useless hands. The room was quiet, and they could faintly hear the relentless cry of the harrier.
"If you like a particular kind of work, you might specialize. Tom knows about wildfires and deforestation. Charlene is our expert on planting techniques."
She nodded at the handsome, hawk-nosed woman whose hair was twisted into an intricate knot at the back of her head. Jean wondered how she managed it in a tent.
Sapaticia said, "So, essential information for our newcomers. The tree project will supply you with room and board and pay for your travel and all equipment and tools. Sometimes you will be living in tents, sometimes in hotels or with a host family. This month, it's tents. The team will work together on the same plot. The work is hard and dirty. Next week, Charlene will show Jean, Felix, and Hugdus how we plant trees. We'll be doing spruce, birch, fir, maples, hemlock on several cut-over degraded plots, and the burned plots, all near enough so we can use this place for our camp. We'll share the cooking, kitchen, and cleanup chores."
"Then this project is not about medicinal plants?" asked Felix. He had noticed that Sapaticia often glanced at Charlene. What was that about?
"It can be medicinal plants where they are natural constituents of an area. Don't jump to the conclusion that medicinal plants only benefit humans. Animals and other plants also use natural medicines. We often have to guess what understory plants belong in the mix because on badly degraded land, we are not entirely sure what was there before the cut. You'll see as we go along."
The male harrier flew from the tree, and his shadow crossed the window.
Sapaticia said, "Tomorrow we will be on the plateau to examine the mixed wood forests."
From the red cupboard, she took a stack of notebooks stamped Breitsprecher Tree Project.
"For field notes. Don't forget to consult the project's online library. A huge amount of information is available."
She took up a sheaf of papers.
"Here are thumbnail descriptions of the geology and soils we'll see tomorrow. Add your personal observations to these notes. And remember that where there are highlands, there must be lowlands, with bogs and marshes. They are not discrete."
"And moose," murmured Felix. He was here. He'd welcome anything he could learn.
"Yes, and otters and beaver, muskrats and dragonflies, mosquitoes, beetles and worms. And how do they all fit into the forest's life? Try to approach questions from the viewpoint of the forest."
She looked at Tom Paulin as she said this. Then, more briskly, "If you have questions about fires and soils, ask Tom. Always share your knowledge." On the pages she passed out, Felix saw a jumble of new words: glacial till, ferrohumic podsols, proterozoic intrusives, glycols, fibrosols. He was excited by the names of the soils. This was real knowledge. Jean had a question that had plagued her since she opened the envelope and saw the check fall out.
"Why us?" she asked. "Why do you think Mi'kmaq people should do this?"
Tom Paulin looked at Jean as if he were on a voyage of discovery and seeing a new land for the first time.
"It is not just Mi'kmaq people working on the project. Some are Mi'kmaq, we are even related, as I'm sure you know, but Hugdus comes from Iceland, and Charlene from Mexico. Tom is from the American South. In Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Cambodia, Sumatra, Vietnam, United States West Coast,
Many of the people working to replant forests and resurrect damaged rivers are the children of indigenous forest residents. Dispossessed people who lived in forests for millennia until recently are the ones who step forward to do the repair work. They are the ones who best understand how to heal the forest. It will take thousands of years for great ancient forests to return. None of us here will see the mature results of our work, but we must try, even if it is only one or two people with buckets of seedlings working to put forest pieces back together. It is terribly important to all of us humans, I can't find the words to say how important, to help the earth regain its vital diversity of tree cover. And the forests will help us. They are old hands at restoring themselves. Now, I'm going out to Sobey's Market. Let's try for supper at 5:30? She left, and they heard the red pickup charge up the hill.
When she mentioned forest people, said Jean to Hugdus, I was going to ask if that idea of idyllic tribes living in wild forest land isn't a myth, like the myth of pristine primeval forest before the white men came. And actually, isn't it a favor to bring those people into modern life now?
Jean, cried Felix. You don't think it was a favor for the French and English to bring the Mi'kmaq into their idea of modern life? I know you don't.
Jean blushed and tensed in embarrassment.
That was different.
Hugdus changed the subject by telling the bizarre story of how the crazy Nazis tried to make the Białowieża forest in Poland into the great primeval wilderness, about their efforts in backbreeding cattle to something they imagined was the extinct oryx. And that started Tom on the sadness of Afghan people chopping down their last pitiful trees to sell for firewood. They talked until they heard the red truck come down the hill. One thing about this group, thought Felix, they really like talking about trees.
Spaghetti tonight, said Sapaticia, coming in with bags of food and bottles of wine. If you don't like the food, you get to be the next cook.
Tom Paulin refilled the wood box, stoked the stove. Charlene put a great pot of water on to boil. Jean and Hugdus chopped onions and green peppers. Felix sliced a large, wrinkled pepperoni sausage into near-translucent discs and found bowls and forks. When Sapaticia mixed the sauce into the pasta, she set the pot directly on the table. As they ate, they talked of their lives and families, but everyone kept looking at Sapaticia. To Jean, who had become an instant disciple, she seemed to stand for all that was good. It was almost dark when they finished. Tom Paulin went outside while the rest of them cleared the table, and Sapaticia rinsed out the teapot. Jean began to wash the dishes. Tom came back in and said, "The moon is coming up." In the window, they all saw the red moon, made ragged by sea fog, rising swiftly out of the ocean, paling as it climbed. It looked close enough to hit with a harpoon and seemed to draw farther away as it rose. Jean knew the moon's apparent recession was only on its rise above the distorting atmosphere, but suppose, she thought, that this time it kept going, becoming smaller and more distant, like the waving hand of someone on a ferry. The old stove radiated heat as they sat with their cups of tea and talked on, picking up on their earlier conversation about the tropics.
It seems, said Sapaticia, you are all more interested in tropical than boreal woodlands.
They are more endangered, aren't they? I keep reading that the forests of Sumatra will be gone in 20 years, said Jean. There is a sense of urgency.
And you think boreal forests are less threatened? A misapprehension. You are attracted to the romance of the tropics. There has been a lot of media attention lately. Disney Company roasted for using wood pulp from poached tropical trees to make children's books. Hardwood floor companies suddenly swearing that they only use ecologically sound, plantation-grown trees. She went on. Charlene, you've spent time in Brazil and Colombia. How many trees and how many tree species would you say grow in Amazonia?
My God, who knows? The diversity is so great and the different species so scattered.
Tom interrupted. I read the Field Museum's report last year that said 16,000 species, and I don't remember how many million trees. Sapaticia nodded.
and they estimate around 390 billion individual trees in the Amazon basin. Tom looked at her.
How the hell can we understand those numbers? North America only has 1,000 species.
16,000! Sapaticia crooked her mouth in a wry smile. Yes, how do we grasp these enormous diverse numbers? But the report also said that half the trees actually belong to a much smaller count of 227 species, the predominance including cacao, rubber, acai berries, Brazil nuts. Charlene poured more tea.
Those are the trees humans have been growing for centuries. Aren't there more of those species because humans have nurtured them?
Sapaticia shrugged. Possibly, we just don't know. Some people are sure those hyperdominants were in the catbird seat because pre-conquest indigenous people grew them. On the other hand, some think they were always dominant and are in a naturally stable state. Quite a nice little puzzle. And that's the allure, she went on. The slippery composition of ecosystems in general. It is uncomfortable to live in a spinning world of hallucinatory change. But how interesting it is.
Tom Paulin leaned forward. Felix thought he had loosened up since dinner. Maybe it was the wine.
I'm thinking about the other end of the Amazonian stick. Not the hyperdominant species, but the rarities. The extinct species. I'm thinking about dark diversity, like dark matter.
Dark diversity?
Felix liked the sound of this.
A little like absent presence. When you pry a sunken stone from the ground, the shape of the stone is still there in the hollow. Absent presence. Say there is a particular rare plant that influences the trees and plants near it. Say conditions change and our rare plant goes extinct, and its absence affects the remaining plants. Dark diversity.
But if conditions change again, will the absent plant return? Asked Jean. Are you saying extinction is not forever?
Sit next to me in the van tomorrow and we'll figure out dark diversity and dark matter. Right now I need sleep.
He thought that she was not pretty, but she had that soft, beautiful skin color. And feelings. And a mind.
No one could sleep under such a moon. Its bitter white light destroyed repose. It was like acid poured over the landscape, seeping into every crevice.
Felix thought first of soil types, then of the unborn millions of tree cutters to come, and Sapaticia's emphasis on how enormously important the work was, not just a job, but a cause, a life work. He had listened to Onahube. Was this the big thing he, Felix, could do? A drowsy thought swam to the surface. He might now actually be doing it. Forest work. Had he gotten around the barrier of college and even the university? Yes, he was at the edge of the forest. This was his start. They could not pull him back. And Jean felt a stream of joy like a narrow sun ray breaking through heavy overcast, a sense that in this one day, her life had become filled with leafy meaning because of Sapaticia's cell.
Tom Paulin, in his travel-worn sleeping bag, was remembering Afghanistan and lost comrades, men welded tightly by searing experiences that outsiders could never understand. There was dark diversity for you. He found civilian life unbearably lonely. He tasted the sour flavor of belonging nowhere but with the old broken group, forever stitched to each other like parts of a coat, the loneliness of a ripped-out sleeve, he thought. And then at Seely Lake, he had found the larches. Running from suicidal despair, he had joined a work crew in an old-growth larch forest where lightning storms fried the summer skies. The Indians had burned underbrush to encourage grassy meadows for deer. But in the last century, thickets of Doug fir crowded out larch sprouts. He touched one tree's soft needles. A thought, unbidden, came. That one of his lost friends was inside that young tree. The burn of anxious grief for that fallen friend began to soften. The work crew had fired the built-up fuel load around the old larches,
and the next year seedlings surged up in their thousands. He went on to different forests, and in each of the young trees he saw the brothers he had lost. The more seedlings he planted, the more of them he resurrected. Sapaticia tossed on her bed in the sleeping loft where once fishermen had stored their gear. It emitted a faint odor of stale bedding and old wool, of ancient sea boots and the wood handles of scaling knives. Every place in the world, she thought, had its own distinctive smell. The smell of old Migamagi must have been wet stones, sea wrack, pine and spruce, mellowing needle duff under the trees, a smell of salted wind and sassafras, of river fish, and the people who lived in it, hair and limbs cleansed in the ever-flowing aromatic air. She rolled onto her side and looked down through a gap in the floorboards and saw moonlight shining on the teacups. She turned again and looked at the glowing sea. Her thoughts surged like the bubbles rising up the sides of a boiling pot. Nothing done. Everything still unsaid. Nothing ready. She had not yet told them of the dangers, that forest restoration workers were attacked and killed, that any kind of interruption to the profitable destruction of forests invited reprisal. She had not mentioned the floods of propaganda and lies that would drown them. She had not told them about the devouring fires, the rich peat bog carbon mass of the boreal Canadian forests that burned hotter than those of Eurasia. The uncontrollable crown fires were changing the Earth's albedo. In the morning, she had to tell them. New thoughts rushed in. Would they work as a group? Not everyone was suited to the life. She thought Felix would be good. He was hungry for the work. Tom Paulin was her rock. He would carry this group, if he stayed alive. Jean might be the finest kind once she found her way. Wait and see. Hugdis would leave in November. And there was Charlene. Charlene sulking again over some imagined wrong. And Myra. No, she did not want to remember. She would not. But there was Myra, rising in her memory. Dark, mestizo activist Myra. Sister, daughter, lover. Yes, and beautiful, too. And the treacherous memory would not stop there, but leapt to Myra on the day she had taken the foreign journalist to see a savagely destructive cut in a protected sanctuary. Red mahogany logs lying on the ground, the butts still wet, when the cutters returned, carrying guns instead of chainsaws. As if they had known. Of course they had known. It was over in seconds, short bursts of gunfire. The photographs had shown Myra cut in half, folded as though she were trying to kiss her own knees. Her knees. Her beautiful, brown, rounded knees. There followed 10 terrible days as Sapaticia and Alfred Onohube staggered through a minefield of pain, confessions of betrayal, grief like a heated knife until their throats were raw, until they were both exhausted by the enormity of what they had lost. And crushing this was the knowledge of another loss so great it obliterated personal dissolution. For after the divorce, she had gone to the ice. On the Greenland glaciers with ice scientists, she suffered a full-force shock of recognition, the coming disappearance of a world believed immutable. She had heard for years that the Earth and its life forms were sensitive to slight temperature changes, that species prospered and disappeared as weather and climate varied, but dismissed these alarms as environmental determinism. On the ice, her thinking shifted as the moon shifts its position in the sky. Historical evidence and the intense scrutiny of contemporary changes sent signals like fiery arrows. The Earth was exquisitely sensitive to solar flares, the shadow of volcanic ash, electromagnetic space storms, subterranean magma movement. All her life, she had assumed polar ice was a permanent feature of Earth. She had not understood. "My God, how violently it is melting," she had whispered to herself. Great fissures thousands of feet deep opened by meltwater that eroded the hard blue ice,
fissures that gaped open to receive the cataract's plunge, down to the rock beneath the great frozen bed, forcing its under-ice way to the sea, lubricating the huge cap from below. Standing near the brink of one ghastly, thundering abyss, someone said, "We are looking at something never before seen." That night, back at the camp, everyone admitted being shaken by the living evidence.
"A great crisis is just ahead," said one scientist. "What we saw this last week," he muttered.
Sapaticia Sell thought he meant that they had been looking at human extinction. She wanted to cry out, "The forests, the trees, they can change everything." But her voice froze in her throat. The ice had frightened her badly, and the next day she called him from the airport.
"Can't we try again? Can't we fix what we broke? I need to be with you. Our lives and our work. I understand now that the work is the most important thing."
Onohube had said, "Some broken things can't be fixed." She, Sapaticia Sell, was here now, and she hadn't given up. But she had to sleep. Had to sleep.
"What can I do but keep on trying? But what if it was all for nothing? What if it was already too late when the first hominid rose up and stared at the world?"
No. What she and so many others were doing was working. It had to work. So many people trying to repair the damage. So selfless, many of them caring and trying. And the forests themselves trying to grow back.
"Oh, God," she groaned. "Oh, God, put out the moon."
In the eastern quadrant of the sky, the moon was small and very white, and its impersonal brilliance showed the rocky coast, ravaged forests, silent feller bunchers, a black glowering mass of peat bog and spiky forest like old negatives. It showed Onohube's white-knuckled grip on the steering wheel. The sea lifted itself toward the light and kept on lifting.
Barkskins was written by Annie Prue and read by Robert Petkoff. The recording engineers were Noriko Okabe, Tyler Whitlatch, Ilya Einhorn, Matthew Longoria, and Justin Davis. Editing by Christina Pichano, with post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Barkskins was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Barkskins is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Bird Cloud by Annie Prue, read by Joan Allen, and The Shipping News by Annie Prue, read by Paul Hecht.